Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is gravitational wave astrophysicist Dr. Chiara Mingarelli. Hey, Chiara, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
Thank you for joining me. I've had several astrophysicists on the show, and it's always fun. That's my background as well, and listeners know that. And so hopefully I won't be too stupid in asking you some interesting questions about your career. You are a gravitational wave astrophysicist, as I introduced you, currently based at the Flatiron Institute Center for Computational Astrophysics, where you are a fellow. You received your PhD from the University of Birmingham in the UK in 2014, and currently you are a gravitational wave researcher astrophysicist. That is very cool. I want to ask you some technical questions about that and have you kind of briefly explain how that all works, especially the tie-in with pulsars, but I'm curious about that. But first, I wanted to get into your background a little bit. It's always fascinating to me how people get into astrophysics. I had Dr. Brian Keating on the show recently, and he talked about how he was looking out the window one night, and the window drapes were illuminated, and he thought he left the light on in the room, and he looked out, and he saw Saturn, and he put a telescope on it, and at that point, he was hooked. And and I had a similar background with the moon looking out my bedroom window. And you tell the story about how when you were growing up, it was dark night sky, and you were fascinated with the stars in the sky and started thinking about astronomy. Is that about how it went?
That's right. I grew up in Rockland, Ontario, which is about 45 minutes outside of Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada. And the night skies were dark and beautiful. And I would often play with my friends. We lived in the country, so it was very safe at night. And we'd run around and you know, sometimes just kind of chill out in the grass and look up at the stars.
How old were you at this point?
I was maybe 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was the most beautiful thing in the world to just stare, and my imagination ran wild, and I would wonder about what was out there, if I could personally ever discover anything, what that discovery might be, and how that could even be possible. And I asked my dad, if who's a mathematician, if there was, you know, such thing as a career that one could have studying the stars. And but I didn't want to just study them. I wanted to figure out how everything worked. And was there such a thing as astrophysics? And he said, yes, indeed, there was. And one could have a career doing that. And so I, as I was growing up, I would save all of my babysitting money to buy Scientific American magazines.
Oh, one of my favorite magazines.
I love it. I loved it. And
you published an article there recently.
I did. That was a very kind of, that was definitely a bucket list item for me. It was fantastic. It was a great experience.
Did you become an amateur astronomer by a telescope?
So I did buy a telescope, but I was really interested in black holes in particular. I thought that they were, you know, elusive and fascinating and simple, but really complicated. They really kind of inspired my creativity. And I loved thinking about black holes and what it meant.
Did you buy a copy of Gravitation? There's no Thorne and Wheeler.
That's right. MTW, we call it in the field. I was a bit young for that still.
Oh, okay.
But I was really just inspired by black holes and what I understood and what I didn't understand. And it really drove my career progression in the sense that if I had a particularly boring class in high school or even during my undergraduate career, I would kind of power through it because I knew I needed to learn this in some way, shape, or form to become an astrophysicist so I could finally discover something about black holes. So it was a really powerful motivation for me and what really drove me to do what I do today.
I remember my undergraduate studies. I knew I was going to have to have two languages to get a BS in astrophysics. And so in high school, I was already planning ahead, taking 4 years of German. So that when I got to college, I only had to take one language. So I was that's planning way ahead. Sounds like what
Very
you were
good.
Doing.
Yeah.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch? Yeah.
Ja, kein Deutsch. Entschuldigung. Ich sage kein Deutsch.
Ein bisschen, ja. Yeah. So, what were some of the other things you had to kind of power through? I mean, science and math looked like it was pretty easy, but sometimes history and English are a little tough for young scientists.
I had a different approach. I was always very good at math, and I found physics to be more challenging, and that's why I liked it, because I really had to work hard at it to be good at it, and then I really felt like I had to apply myself to get really good grades in physics. I found English and history and those subjects to be fascinating, but also they weren't particularly inspiring for me. And so I chose the most challenging subject and decided that I was going to be amazing at it.
Where did you go to undergraduate school?
So I grew up outside of Ottawa. So I did my undergraduate degree at Carleton University in Ottawa, and I did a double major in math and physics.
So how did you end up in the UK then for your doctorate? How did that work?
Yeah, so after my undergraduate degree, I moved to Italy, and I did a master's degree in Bologna at the University of Bologna in astrophysics and cosmology. And I wanted to do a master's before starting a PhD because my undergraduate training was, in pure math and theoretical physics, but none of the astrophysics. So I wanted to make sure that I had solid foundation in astrophysics before starting. So I did a 2-year master's program.
Did you just pack up and go by yourself to Italy?
I did. Yeah.
Adventures plus.
Yes.
Wow.
It was definitely an adventure. And all my courses were in Italian, and my father's family is Italian.
I wanted to ask you about that. My name is Marcellero, which is Italian, and I was wondering whether Mingarelli was Italian as well.
Yes, absolutely. It's very Italian. It's actually from Bologna originally. So going to Bologna was also part of me exploring my Italian roots. On my mother's side, I'm very Canadian. I think yes and no. So I have 6 brothers and sisters, 3 brothers and 3 sisters. And my younger sister is in veterinary school, so she's also pursuing a technical career. And of course, I'm an astrophysicist, but my other siblings don't have the same interests. So for me, the important part of having my father as a mathematician was to course correct some things that I learned in school. So I had some very negative experiences early on in math classes, even though I was always very good at it.
I wanted to ask you about that. When I was growing up, doors weren't so open for women in astrophysics. I think Lisa Randall might have had a role to play in opening up some doors. But nowadays, it's sort of built into our mental thinking and our institutions. But sometimes it can be kind of yuff for a young person, especially if a female in a male-dominated field.
Yes, absolutely. It's hard to understand how much that influenced people when I was in high school. But I did have some teachers who were very discouraging and who, you know, would essentially tell me that I was asking stupid questions. And, you know, I would go home and tell my dad what I was thinking about. And it would be something that was related to group theory or something that was related to, you know, abstract math concepts. And he said, no, you're brilliant. You're not stupid. Your teacher just didn't understand the question. And so I was really lucky to have someone who could tell me that. Because, of course, when you hear that as a teenager, it's extremely discouraging. Yeah. You already have enough problems and enough other things going on in your head that if your math teacher tells you that you're actually no good, you'll probably be inclined to believe them. And in fact, I think a lot of my, success, for lack of a better word, but the fact that I'm still here is due to the fact that I try not to listen to the naysayers too much, and I just keep going.
Was there one teacher or professor who believed in you, who kind of turned the tide? Sometimes that happens.
So there were a few people who were important to me. So as an undergraduate, Peter Watson at Carleton University was very supportive. So I went to see him and I asked him if we could have a fourth year physics class in astrophysics. And he said, okay, well, there's a special class that we can do. It's like a directed studies class. And if you can get four other physics students to sign up to do astrophysics with you, then I'll offer the class. So I went around and I convinced everyone that was in fourth year physics to take this class. And so the entire year ended up taking the class. And he thought that was really funny. So I got my astrophysics class. And he wrote me a letter of reference. And eventually I took that with me to Bologna to be admitted to the master's program.
Cool. At this point, were you focusing on gravitational waves at this part of your master's, or is it just catching up on the astrophysics part of it, as you said?
Yeah, it was more just catching up on things that were very astrophysics related, galaxy clusters, the life and death of stars, things like that that I hadn't learned. But I did realize that my technical training in math and physics was invaluable and also very good. So I was really happy that I had such a strong technical background before starting.
Yeah, I saw a tweet from Brian Green the other day about what you needed to know if you wanted to study string theory, and it was an awesome list. Differential geometry, tensors, linear algebra. Wow, it was an amazing list. You can't be an astrophysicist without knowing your math, and probably without being pretty good at computer computations, because a lot of things today, like gravitational evolution of galaxies and dark energy, are all based on simulations, right?
There's a huge amount of computational methods today. And if I were to give advice to anyone who wants to pursue a career in astrophysics or even in any kind of theoretical physics, I would definitely recommend learning at least one computer programming language well.
Usually Fortran and or Python would be good ideas. Java, not so much. Java's more like enterprise business, but couldn't go wrong with Perl or Python and Fortran, right?
I think Python and C++ are key the field right
C++
now.
C++ is a good thing to know, right?
Absolutely.
Well, it's time to take a break. When we come back in the second half, I wanted to chat with you about some of the technical issues of your research. Folks, I'm chatting with gravitational astrophysicist Dr. Chiara Mingarelli. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Hi, this is John Marcellaro with the Mac Observer. This week, our sponsor is Simple Contacts. If you wear contact lenses and find yourself dreading that annual appointment to renew your prescription, then you're going to love Simple Contacts. This new company makes an annoying process very simple. Simple Contacts lets you renew your expired contact lens prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from your phone or computer in minutes. Simple Contacts brings the doctor's office to wherever you are, whenever you need it. You can take the Simple Contacts vision test online in 5 minutes. A real doctor reviews it and renews your prescription. You save time, money, and save yourself a headache. And if you have an unexpired prescription, just upload a photo of it or your doctor's info and order your lenses in minutes for a great price. All the hard work is done for you. Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses, and their prices are unbeatable. The prescription is just $20. Compare that with an annual appointment, which can be up to $250 without insurance. They have some of the best prices on contacts, and shipping is free. Best of all, listeners here will get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. Just go to simplecontacts.com/BGM or enter the code BGM at checkout. Note, by the way, that this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but this is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and renew your contacts if your vision has not changed. Again, check out Simple Contacts and get $30 off by going to simplecontacts.com/BGM or just enter the code BGM at checkout. Give it a try. And thanks, Simple Contacts, for being our sponsor. We're back. I'm chatting with Dr. Chiara Mingarelli, astrophysicist. So let's talk about gravitational waves. Give us the grand story. I'm interested in what gravitational wave is and how they're formed. And then let's talk about how you use pulsars and how they fold into that research.
Sure. Sounds great. So gravitational waves are ripples in the fabric of space-time that travel at the speed of light.
Space-time, not space.
That's right, in space-time. So they affect, you can think of them as time delays or changes in distance. All of these things are connected in Einstein's general theory of relativity. So gravitational waves travel at the speed of light and originate from some of the most violent processes in the universe, like black hole mergers. And so an easy way to think about gravitational waves and how they affect the world around us is to think of yourself as being on a boat on the surface of the ocean. And there can be little waves sometimes and big waves. And you're just bobbing up and down on the surface of the ocean. You're not trying to move. It's the surface of the ocean that's moving. So this is a kind of easy analogy of what gravitational waves do. They change the distance between two objects.
How hard are they to detect?
Very difficult to detect. They were proposed over 100 years ago now by Einstein. And even after Einstein proposed the existence of gravitational waves, people weren't really sure that they existed at all until the 50s. People kept changing their minds and thought, oh, this can't be real, it can't be right, or if it's right, we'll never be able to detect it. Because the currency, the figure that we use to describe the strength of a gravitational wave is called the strain. And the strain is a change in distance over distance or a change in time over time. So for something like the LIGO detector, which made the first detection of gravitational waves, this change in distance was the fraction of the size of a proton, right? This is really, really, really small.
10 to the minus 12 meters or so?
This was over 4 kilometers. So this was an extremely sensitive engineering feat. For pulsar timing arrays, because we use pulsars, which I'll describe to you in a second, the same figure is about 10 to the minus 15. So they're much stronger than the LIGO sources are. But this is something like 1 meter over a light year that you have to be able to constrain.
Wow.
So these are incredible things to be able to detect and very, very difficult.
Tell us briefly, in 30 seconds, can you tell us briefly what LIGO stands for and where they are and what they do? How they work?
Sure. So LIGO is the Laser Interferometer Gravitation Wave Observatory. And it's they use laser light that they separate into two arms. So you take a laser that comes in and it gets separated into two beams. And the beams travel 4 kilometers down, hit some mirrors, and come back and recombine at a port that detects the light. So that it's set up so that the light interferes destructively with itself, which means that there's no light. And if a gravitational wave goes by, it'll change the length of one arm with respect to the other and has this stretching and squashing motion, and that lets light go in.
Does that mean the wave is polarized?
So gravitational waves from single sources are indeed polarized. This stretching and squashing causes some of the light to get in. And in a very distinctive way, you can tell if this is from a black hole merger or a neutron star merger or black hole neutron star merger. All this information is contained in the signal that comes from these lasers.
How do we calculate the mass of these black holes that are generating the wave? Is there a way to back out? I guess there is, from the strain to the size of the black hole.
The strain is proportional to a combination of the black hole masses to the power of five-thirds. But practically how it's measured is that when you see two black holes merging in this signal, if you could hear the signal, it would sound like a chirp, which would go like whoop. Mm-hmm. And when it does the whoop sound, this is the chirp. And the black hole mass can be directly measured from the chirp. So that part of the signal contains information about the black hole.
How do you calculate the relative mass of the two? I've seen numbers like one black hole was 30 and one was 40 solar masses or something like that. How do you figure out if they're different?
So this chirp mass is a function of the total mass of the binary system and the mass ratio of the binary system. And so with a little bit of fancy footwork, you can disentangle the two.
Cool.
Yeah.
So how do pulsars fit into the picture now?
Right. So LIGO can detect gravitational waves that are very high frequency, so hundreds of hertz to kilohertz. Which if you were able to hear them, you could actually hear this kind of merger happening with your ears. But they're a fundamentally different kind of beast. With pulsar timing arrays, what happens is that pulsars, which are neutron stars that emit radio waves, they were discovered by Jocelyn Bell 50 years ago. As they sweep around and spin, they send bursts of radio waves towards the Earth. And these radio waves arrive very, very regularly. So their time of arrivals can be timed to hundreds of nanoseconds and sometimes even better than that.
Cosmic clocks, as Neil deGrasse Tyson would say.
Exactly. They are excellent clocks and they're like cosmic lighthouses. And so if a gravitational wave passes through the Milky Way galaxy where we're timing all of these pulsars, and then the pulsar's distance gets changed, right, because the gravitational wave will stretch and squash the fabric of space-time, we can detect this happening. So we know when the pulsar radio waves should arrive. We measure when they do arrive, and the difference between the two can signal the presence of a gravitational wave. So it's important to look for this signal in many, many pulsars, and we're still maybe 2 or 3 years away from making the first detection. But this is a completely different experiment. This experiment is the size of the galaxy and is sensitive to supermassive black hole binaries. So these are 100 million to a billion times the mass of the sun, whereas LIGO is sensitive to stellar mass black holes, which means that they are maybe a few to 10 times the mass of the sun. But you could never detect supermassive black holes with LIGO.
Okay. Very interesting. Very interesting. So we're not yet run out of time, but we're getting there. So I want to kind of wrap up with a discussion about how you think this research is of value. Does the whole field of gravitational wave study lead towards confirmation, better confirmation, or different kind of confirmation of Einstein's theory of general relativity? Or is that not in question, but does it provide additional confirmation, or does it do something else?
Well, it's always in question. We should always question the theories that we use and be skeptical of our own science and even of our own results. Absolutely, as scientists, we can't take anything for granted. One of the things that we can test, of course, is Einstein's theory of gravity. We can also test other theories of gravity. With pulsar timing arrays, because we measure gravitational waves from supermassive black holes, these supermassive black holes live in the centers of massive galaxies, and the binary systems that emit gravitational wave come from galaxy mergers. So, in essence, the gravitational waves that I'm interested in trace galaxy mergers, and galaxy mergers are a fundamental part of how we understand the universe to work. So the non-detection of gravitational waves is also really interesting from the point of view of large-scale structure formation in the universe and how we think the universe works, because the black holes are supposed to merge at a certain rate depending on different theories. So we can test these theories with the detection or the non-detection of gravitational waves. If we were biased towards black holes of a certain mass, we would also be able to rule that in or rule that out with our observations. So there's a lot of things that we can understand about the universe from gravitational waves that are detected with pulsar timing arrays.
Just out of curiosity, is there any applicability to our understanding of dark matter or dark energy?
So for dark matter, it's possible in theory to probe the content and cores of galaxies by looking at their gravitational wave signals. the binary may evolve faster if there's dark matter there. So we would be able to see that kind of signal, potentially in pulsar timing or in LISA signals. So LISA would be like a LIGO in space. And this is scheduled to launch in 2034. This is a European Space Agency project that NASA just recently joined.
Interesting. Well, that's quite a story. We are out of time right now. I want to thank you very much for this grand tour of the universe and the research that you're doing. It sounds like very exciting work, and I think you're having a lot of fun.
Absolutely. I love it.
Say, tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter name is Chiara Mingarelli. And so that's at Dr._C. Mingarelli. So that's C-M-I-N-G-A-R-E-L-L-I.
Great. And I will put your bio page and your article at Amy Poehler's Smart Girls into the show notes. Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show. It's an interesting tour of gravitational wave astrophysics. Thanks again.
Great. Thanks, John.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll be back next week.